Translation. This appears to be Nag Ramachandra speaking.
That is the wife of...
No, that's right, yeah. That's Nandodari. Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah, Nandodari speaking. O pleasure of the Rakshasa dynasty, because of you the state of Lanka and also we ourselves now have no protector. By your deeds you have made your body fit to be eaten by vultures and your soul fit to go to hell. Purport. One who follows the path of Ravana is condemned in two ways. His body is fit to be eaten by dogs and vultures and the soul goes to hell. As stated by the Lord himself in Bhagavad Gita, Tavaham dvishata kruran saṃsāreṣu narādhamān kṣipyāṁ yajasraṁ aśubhāṁ āśurishvena yonishu. Those who are envious and mischievous, who are the lowest among men, are cast by me into the ocean of material existence, into various demoniac species of life. Thus the destination of godless atheists such as Ravana, Hiranyakashipu, Kamsa and Dantavakra is a hellish condition of life. Mandodari, the wife of Ravana, could understand all this because she was a chaste woman. Although lamenting for the death of her husband, she knew what would happen to his body and soul. For although one cannot see directly with one's material eyes, one can see with the eyes of knowledge. Pashyanti jnana chakshushaha. In Vedic history, there are many instances of how one becomes godless and is condemned by the laws of nature. Om jnana timiram bhasya jnananjana shalakaya chakshurin vinitam yena tasmai shri guravinamaha nava sheshtam bhagavapi shakti putram atra surupam rupam tasya gajam gurupurim maturim goshtantim radha kundam girivaramaho radhika matanasham prato yasya pratita kripaya shivaram tamitosu Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yatav Paragamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavas Cha Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Rakhanatam Tam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Paritana Sahitam Krishna Paitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakhanitas Cha. So, in this purport, Srila Prabhupada quotes one line from a verse in the Bhagavad Gita, Pashanti Jnana Chakshushaha, which means they see with the eye of knowledge. Ukramantam stitam bhapi punjanam bhagavam vitam vimura nanu pashanti pashanti jnana chakshushaha. Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna states that how the living being goes from one body to another, leaves one body and goes to another, is not seen by persons who are extremely foolish, but it is seen by persons who have the eye of knowledge, which indicates that those who do not have the eye of knowledge, meaning they see with they see with knowledge. They don't just see, but they see with knowledge. That anyone who does not have the eye of knowledge is, ipso facto, a big fool. Seeing with the eye of knowledge, of course this is a metaphorical term, it means that well, it doesn't mean that one sees anything different. The sensation of seeing of a person in knowledge and of a fool is the same. A person in knowledge, when he sees a tree, he sees the same outline of the tree as does a big fool. Now, the person in knowledge, here it means the person in knowledge of the transmigration of birth and death. Tattva-gyan means knowledge of, just as yesterday we were reading in Śrīla Prabhupāda's purport, higher than knowledge of religious principles is knowledge of matter, spirit, and the supreme. So that is called tattva-gyan, or the nature of, knowledge of the nature of existence of all that be. Now, it might be that someone sees with a different kind of eye of knowledge. A botanist or an ecologist may have more knowledge about the tree than a person who has knowledge of tattva-gyan. A person with tattva-gyan, he doesn't just see a tree, he sees that here is a living entity who is being forced to take the body of a tree due to past sinful activities, such as, for instance, Srila Prabhupada stated that persons who like to go naked, which is uncivilized, except in the case of highly advanced spiritualists, sometimes they also go naked also, as Lord Rishabdev did, for instance. In the Jains, one division is Digamba, and means they wear the directions for their clothes, which means they go naked. Sometimes you see them walking in the street, Jain sadhus, naked. Although Jainism in itself is rejectable, but a highly advanced person, male, may go naked. But for persons to do so for sensuous reasons or any other reason than for self-realization is highly sinful. So, within nature, one gets the destination for which one is suited is by the workings of material nature, and thus someone who is a nudie, they get the body of a tree. That's what happens. So those who don't see this, those who don't realize this, Udkramantans Titang Bhapi Bhunjanam Bhagunanditam Vimura Nanu Pashyanti. They don't see. The foolish people don't see how the laws of nature are working. The term given here is anupashyanti, which means that indicates that one can actually see this through the parampara system. You don't just doesn't come automatically, as some foolish people, another kind of foolish people, they think that you just sit and meditate and enlightenment comes automatically, as was advertised to have been done by the Buddha. But of course, his realization wasn't on a very high level, his enlightenment. So, this is how a person in knowledge sees, in knowledge of tattva-vit. It's another term used in Bhagavad Gita. Tattva-vit, higher than that stage is tattva-darshi, one who actually sees, experiences the truth. But the first stage is tattva-vit, to be knowledgeable of the nature of reality. Now, someone else may see the tree with a different kind of eye of knowledge, as I stated, a botanist or an ecologist or a forester, or someone who studies forest science. What's the technical term for that? Anyone? I don't know. That's a specialized branch of botany. So they will also see the tree in a different way to that of an ordinary person. An ordinary person just sees a tree and doesn't think much about it. You probably wouldn't even register seeing a tree within your consciousness. We see so many trees and we don't really think about them. And so many trees here, we don't think much about them. I thought about the bamboos when I came here. It's unexpected to see bamboo in Ireland. didn't register much about it. I also saw, I noticed the oak tree also, because oak is so much part of the British culture that I was raised in. But hadn't seen them for a long time, so I happened to register that. But normally you wouldn't register trees. But a botanist, he sees that a tree, especially a tree like an oak tree, a developed oak tree, it's like a whole organism in itself. It's not just a tree, but there are so many living entities in the branches, in the wood, in the roots, who are taking shelter of that tree. Birds and microbes and worms and bugs. So it's a whole microcosmic universe in itself. And one who has specialized knowledge, they can see certain things about the tree which other people can't see, just like they may see if it's diseased, which someone else might not be able to notice. Or the date trees or other palm trees in those who, they may not have a technical education, but those who collect the sap, and they can understand what is the best time to do so. So the people who are educated, they're able, although they see the same thing as everyone else, but they see, because they see with their eye of knowledge, they see more. They register more. They understand more. That's why in English we say, I see means I understand. So real seeing is not just seeing, but understanding. Someone else may see that tree. From another perspective, he may have more knowledge than others also. Just like someone who has a timber, who's running a timber mill. He may say, well, this tree is suitable for cutting. It's at an age where if it can be cut profitably, or this tree is not fit at all for cutting, it didn't grow properly. So with different varieties of knowledge, one sees the same object in different ways. And the example is given that generally a man sees a woman as beautiful. A dog sees her as a walking lump of flesh. And as a self-realized person sees her in the same way he sees a stone. There's no attraction. So there is different ways of seeing, not according to knowledge, but according to mentality. So what does it mean to see? Krishna says here, jnana chakshusha, seeing with the eye of knowledge, which is why we're studying here Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, daily to see with the eye of knowledge. Mandodari, who's speaking in this verse, she spoke with knowledge. It was common knowledge to people in Vedic culture. Ravana was also within Vedic culture. He was the son of a rishi, Brahmin by birth, who he was very much part of the Vedic culture, but just that he was a maverick, I guess you could say. He was a hippie of sorts. He believed in free love, that whoever I want to love, I'll just freely pick them up, and who cares for marriage and all this kind of stuff. If she's beautiful, grab her. Like that. That was his policy. But in many ways, he did follow the Vedic culture. He also knew the Vedas. At least one of his sons, Indrajit, was expert in performing yajnas, although he performed yajna sacrifices for the sake of harming others, not for good purposes. They can be performed also. And for attaining magic powers, what nowadays we would call magic powers. so that, for instance, he could fly in the sky during battle unseen, which makes him a pretty difficult opponent to fight with. That gives him a lot of advantage. So they were in Vedic culture, in which it's, all these points are understood, that one has to die and take birth again and be punished for one's sinful activities. Hiranyakashipu also knew this. Hiranyakashipu, who became Ravana. When Hiranyaksha died, Hiranyakashipu gave a great speech. We could speak it in the Srimad Bhagavatam class about how we all have to die and according to our activities, we have to take birth and we shouldn't lament for this. So he knew all of these things, but still he was a demon. Even though he had this knowledge, Ravana had this knowledge, but due to excessive material desire, he didn't care to put that into practice for his benefit. He thought that he could break the system. He thought, by my own power, I'll defy the system. Hiranyakashipu also. They knew the laws of nature. Here I'm not talking about, you know, what the biologists and chemists and physicists say, but the laws of karma, the laws of the subtle workings of the universe. So they knew that, but they were so proud and foolish. Generally a proud person thinks, I'm not foolish, everyone else is foolish, but actually pride is foolish. But they were so proud and foolish that they thought they could defy the laws of nature by their own strength. Which means that they didn't really understand the laws of nature in all their workings, which is the common or the major mistake of most people in Vedic culture. They know some of the basics, that we go from body to body to body, but who's behind it all? What's the purpose? They don't know. They don't know that Krishna is behind everything, and the purpose of following the Vedic culture is to serve Krishna. But many people, they take the knowledge of the Vedic culture and try to dovetail it, to use a Prabhupada term, for their own sense gratification. Okay, so we take birth after birth, alright, and you get what you deserve, alright, let me act piously, and in my next life I can enjoy very nicely sense gratification. So, although they may see how one changes from body to body, they're not really jnana chakshusha. They don't really have the knowledge of how one goes from one body to another. So, now, this verse, this one line of which has been quoted, says that one who sees with the eye of knowledge sees how one goes from one body to another. So, and others are very foolish who don't see this. But it may be that some people who see that, but they don't fully understand it, and therefore they're also vimuha, they're also greatly foolish, because they don't properly understand it. They don't properly understand why this is going on, and that it is miserable, and that we should escape from it. So knowledge of how we pass from one body to another, that in and of it, and of itself, does not constitute spiritual knowledge. It's preliminary, but there's so much more to be learned. And we see that nowadays, even in the Western world, many people accept that we get reactions for our activities. In fact, on the plane, British Airways from Delhi to London, a couple of days ago, just 3 days ago, almost. Anyway, quite not very long ago. As I went to the back of the plane to get some water to drink, and there were the air hostesses reading the Daily Mirror or the Sun or some other similarly unenlightened tract. and talking about Kate, the new Duchess of somewhere or other. Where? Duchess of? No. You read the papers even less than me. Well done. Anyway, she's the wife of the Rajkumar. What's that called? The prince in waiting, the king in waiting? What's the term for that?
Regent?
No, not regent. That's from the other way. What's that called? The next, the king to be. Crown prince. That's what it's called, crown prince. So she's, I'm not even sure if it's the crown. No, the Prince Charles is one down the line. Anyway, she's famous because she married a prince. And there's something, some criticism of her, or something like that in the paper. And one of these highly enlightened air hostesses made some comment. And the other one, in response, said, "Well, it's her karma." That was the point I wanted to make. It's her karma for something or something or something that she did before, for being so nasty. I can't remember exactly what. But from the tone in which she said it, I could understand that she was only half joking. The point that she, even in English language, prior to the concept of karma entering, largely through Prabhupada's books, I presume, someone who, something bad happens to them, someone might say, well, they deserved it. So there's an undeveloped, almost intuitive understanding of karma right there, isn't it? Or he got that, it was coming to him. I'm saying that was coming to him. So there's almost intuitively an understanding of the laws of karma. But that doesn't constitute full, even if one has some understanding, it doesn't constitute full knowledge. Yeah, many people nowadays in the Western world, I believe there was some survey done recently in America, for all that surveys may be worth, which said that something like 40% of the people, I can't remember the figures exactly, obviously, 40% of the people in America believe in reincarnation and karma, and another 30% or so believe that it's quite possible, but they're not quite sure. Something like that. So, many people have an idea of karma, rebirth, but they don't have a clear idea of Krishna behind it and the goal of life to live out this human life in such a way that one becomes Krishna conscious. Most people don't understand that. They may have a vague idea of reincarnation, but they don't understand about Krishna. Many people also who accept the principle of reincarnation, they think that, well, you must come back as a human. You can't come back as anything else but a human. Little do they know the actual facts. You could come back as a tree, or a tiger, or a worm in stool, as Srila Prabhupada often graphically put it, or a cockroach. Come back as a cockroach. Srila Prabhupada gave the example, just as used to be a tradition in India. I came to India just in time to see quite a lot of the culture before it all got washed under tidal wave of westernization. So people used to put their deceased father's photograph in their house. And Prabhupada gave the example that the photo is in the house and the son is offering a stick of incense to him daily. The son doesn't know that the father is still living in the house. Due to his attachment to it, the father has become a cockroach. in the commode, which is a, I guess that's Indian English for lavatory, toilet, bathroom, and many other less parliamentary terms for the place where you, the designated place for relieving your, yeah, anyway, you know what I'm talking about. So, he's become a cockroach in the commode. The son is worshipping the picture with incense. He's become a cockroach in the commode. Or as my godbrother told me many years ago, he was in Sweden and rented a place in Stockholm. Srila Prabhupada came there. And when they opened the door to one of the rooms, a rat ran out. And Srila Prabhupada said, that was the owner of the building. It was the previous owner. He came back again as a rat due to his attachment to the building. So many people don't accept that. That they think that, well, you have to become human. But they don't know that if you cultivate animalistic consciousness, it's you get what you deserve. And not only what you deserve, but what you want, actually. Because, for instance, if people want to have a lot of sexual activity, the human body is really one of the worst, actually, because only in human life is there marriage, and all the responsibility that goes with that. Of course, many animals and birds, they do live as mates throughout life, but in human society, especially in the modern ages, this whole thing of money and so many rules and so many unwritten rules, social normative standards, and it's quite a trip. And if you just want to enjoy sex, it's a lot easier just to pick up a girlfriend or boyfriend or whichever your preference, and just do it. But even then, there's so many just having sexual relationships left, right, and center is very much at the risk of acquiring sexually transmitted diseases, which are all very nasty, and one has to get a hellish existence for such sinful activity. Whereas in animal life, which is a hellish existence that you get, you don't have to worry. For instance, a dog, he doesn't have any consideration of marriage or responsibility. Dogs in this country, of course, they're restricted by their owners, but in India, they're mostly free to run around, and whenever they can find a bitch in heat and fight off the other dogs, then they can just enjoy themselves to their full heart's pleasure. And as Srila Prabhupada often noted, pigeons, they engage in sexual activity, they just go on doing it. Right? If you see pigeons, they're just probably all the time just trying to jump on the pigeon is going doot, 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 and the she pigeon is going doot, 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 and running away, and then eventually catches her, and you can fill in the dotted lines yourself what happens next. So, people don't realize, but you do get, you'll get the kind of body that you want. If you want sexual activity, then the pigeon body is much more suitable for that. Or if one likes to eat meat, then one is entitled to get the body of a tiger or any other carnivorous animal. So people don't know this. They may have a vague idea of what is called reincarnation, but they don't have a clear idea. Bhakti Charishaya, His Holiness, told me a few years ago that he was invited to a conference in Switzerland on reincarnation. There are all these different people. Paranormal investigators. is Santanapura, which again I don't remember. And Buddhists and all kinds of people. He said he was in, and none of them had any idea what they were talking about. He said he was the only one who, and everyone else could recognize that also, but he was the only one who had any clear knowledge. Otherwise, they just no idea exactly what Krishna says, how the living entity transfers from one body to another. They may have a vague idea, but they don't have any idea of the science of it. So, Ravana had some idea, but not a clear idea. Mandodari has some idea. Some idea. She's not a pure devotee. She's a great personality, no doubt. She's mentioned as one of the ideal wives, even though she was married to such a rascal as her husband, but she was still an ideal wife, which is an interesting rejoinder to those who say that, well, if I get a husband like Ram, then I'll be like Sita. But one of the ideal wives in traditional culture is Mandodari. You had, well, as a husband, I mean, he did pick up many other girls, but he didn't abandon his prime wife, or main wife. So, having many wives in and of itself is not against dharma, actually, for a kshatriya. Ravana, although the son of a brahmin, was living the life of something like a kshatriya, perverted kind of life. Actually, kshatriyas are meant for protecting against people like him, but he was the perverted reflection of a kshatriya. So especially kshatriyas, they often have many wives, and that's considered good, because it's good for them, because they have the strength and propensity to do so, and it's good for the women who would otherwise remain unmarried. So, Mandodari is a great personality in some ways. And she has knowledge of how we pass, of that we pass from body to body. She even knew her husband was sinful and wrong. And she told him, as many others, or at least several others told him, but Ravana was too proud and foolish to listen to good advice. So we're very fortunate that by the grace of Shukadeva Goswami, Vyasadeva, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and all the mercy of the previous acharyas is received by us through Srila Prabhupada, that we're able to, as Srila Prabhupada has written these books, to study them and get actually better knowledge than even many great personalities in the past have had. Namely, knowledge of matter, spirit, and the supreme detailed knowledge of all of this, by which we can, by applying that knowledge in our life, we can achieve the perfection of life, which is to go beyond birth and death, go back home, back to Godhead, to serve Krishna in the spiritual world eternally. Hare Krishna. Is there any question about this? No. Anyone? 3, 2, yeah, Mahesha always has a question.
I'm just trying to understand the Mandodari.
Mandodari, yeah.
Yeah, her obligation to Ravana. I mean, she's saying here you're fit to go to hell.
What is Mandodari's obligation to Ravana? She should have divorced him long ago.
Knowing that, like, because I raise the question because
knowing that he's a bad man.
Yeah, because you see sometimes, like, I know in Northern Ireland, like, people would be married to terrorists and they knew that they were blowing people up and killing them, but they wouldn't.
The wife in Northern Ireland is married to a terrorist, yeah. And they know that they're killing people and blowing them up. That's called a terrorist if you're on the wrong side. And if you're on the side, on the right side, it's called a, what's it called? Army officer or something.
Freedom fighter.
Freedom fighter is what the terrorists call themselves. But it's just, you know, who's in power, they're called the good guys, and who's not in power, they're called the bad guys. Where if you're in another country and you don't like the present government and you want to make it fall down, then you call the terrorists freedom fighters, and you call the government corrupt, and like that, for instance, as I was saying yesterday, like in Iraq, Saddam Hussein was the excuse, although there are plenty of rulers at least as bad as him, for instance in Saudi Arabia, but America's never done an attack on them. Anyway, let's not talk too much about politics. So, the wives of terrorists, aka freedom fighters, they don't, what's that word, they don't tell the police.
Yeah,
they just go on, yeah.
So
is that right or is that wrong? Ah, that's a very interesting question, isn't it? Well, if we apply the principle that we see here of Mandodari, she advised Ravana repeatedly that what you're doing is wrong. But she didn't defy him. She went on serving him. She didn't... What's the word when you tell on someone?
Grass.
Betray. She didn't betray him in the sense of... she was not really in a position to do so anyway. Vibhishana did. Vibhishana, after warning Ravana so many times that what you're doing is wrong, eventually defected to the right side. Yeah, it's a very interesting question, because Bhishma and Drona, even though they were great personalities, they were still considered great personalities, even though they were fighting on the wrong side. So, should the wife of a terrorist grass on him? According to Dharma principles. Well, first of all, there's no dharma either on the side of the IRA or the side of the British government. Neither of them have any idea of dharma. Both of them are killing cows, for instance. The aim of the IRA is to so-called liberate Northern Ireland so that the whole of Ireland can be one big cow slaughtering place. Why separate the two cow slaughtering states? So they're both highly adharmic. The wife would not be advising the terrorist to come to the position of dharma, whereas Mandodari was. So that's a significant difference. She was advising him to follow dharma, whereas although it's seen as very bad, and it is very bad, that terrorists, for instance, blow people up, but the whole state is bad. Killing cows is at least as bad as killing human beings, according to Vedic understanding. So, you know, there's all this big fuss against terrorism, anti-terrorism, but this was dreamed up as a political ploy. It could be stated by especially the Bush, the second Bush administration, or the George Bush, the third administration. But America is a terrorist state. I mean, apart from all the CIA activities all over the world, there are literally millions of living beings being slaughtered every day in America, literally. If you take all the chickens and pigs and cows, those three animals especially, and they're tortured all their lives. So people don't see this. They think that, well, it's okay just to kill the animals, but it's not. There's a karmic response for that. So should the wife grass on the husband or just go on with what she's doing? Well, from the dharmic standpoint, she should become Krishna conscious and advise her husband too also. You may say, well, that doesn't sound very practical or realistic. But it's not impossible, and as long as one is within this demoniac culture, then whichever side you take, you're wrong. Who's right? The British government or the IRA? The answer is they're both wrong. Neither of them are right. So whichever side you're on, you're wrong. So the question doesn't really apply. It's that example I gave yesterday of the in Auschwitz, I believe it was, or one of the killing camps. The governor of the camp organized an orchestra to play for the people being marched to the gas chambers. So was that a good thing to do or not? The enormity of their being sent to the gas chamber completely outweighs the question of whether or not there should be an orchestra playing for them. It's not it's the wrong question. Well, do you think we should have an orchestra or not? Well, it'll cost so much money and those men, because they could be engaged in the war effort. And two, the governor and his assistant might be arguing. Of course, in Nazi Germany, no one argues. Otherwise, you get sent to the gas chamber. But you could have an ethical argument or about whether or not it's right to have an orchestra play, but it's the wrong question. It's not the issue. It picked up the wrong issue. So it may seem, well, that's a very major issue. Should the wife go on with her husband or grass on him or what? Actually, he's not a very good terrorist if the wife knows what's going on. Even the wife shouldn't know too much, right? It's supposed to keep things secret. So, yeah, that's my answer to my question. That's my answer to your question. Anything else? Yeah.
Talking about persons like Hiranyakashipu and Lavana, who were familiar with the dharmic principles and were of a demoniac nature. Well, could it be possible that there are people familiar with the dharmic, well, in Krishna consciousness?
Can it be possible there are people in Krishna consciousness who
familiar with all the
familiar with all the rules and regs, but they're demons?
Yes.
It is possible.
What comes to mind is a statement that Srila Prabhupada made when he was speaking to Hans Dutta back in 1970. He said that the great sinister movement is within our society. So that's the point I was trying to make. What would it be? Two questions.
Prabhupada said to Hans Dutta, the great sinister movement is within our society.
Yes.
I'm not familiar with that. Maybe you could...
Surprised.
Maybe you could... I can imagine what it's in relation to. You could let me know about that quote. It is possible, but as I see, Srila Prabhupada's policy was to anyone who came to the movement, he would try to keep them in with the faith that somehow or other, if they follow the process, they'll be purified, as is Rupa Goswami's guideline, by which Prabhupada, he had faith that the people of completely sinful and ignorant backgrounds could become purified. Yena tena prakarena mana krishna nirdeshaya. That somehow or other bring people to Krishna consciousness, and if they take to the process, they'll be purified. When I was first in India, especially in Bengal, West Bengal, a lot of people believed that we were CIA members, and the question even came up in the Indian Parliament. And I believe Indira Gandhi herself replied that we have investigated, and they're not CIA members. But a lot of people thought that we were CIA members due to one magazine in Bombay had sensationalist magazine called Blitz had made this propaganda. So often people used to ask us this, and we would say that, well, CIA members, they can't follow what we follow, getting up early in the morning, following all these prisoners, no meat, no illicit sex, no intoxication, gambling. I guess CIA members shouldn't do that, but the other three, they may or may not do, I mean, apart from gambling with their lives. But we say, first of all, they can't do it, and if they do do it, they'll become devotees. They'll become purified if they follow all our principles. So that seems to be Srila Prabhupada's principles. In relation to the devotee you just mentioned, I also heard that from a German devotee that this once when the devotee you just mentioned had just left the room, and at that time you could say he was causing a lot of trouble to Prabhupada in some ways, and Prabhupada said, I heard this, it's hearsay. Prabhupada said, there are so many demons in this movement. Saying, well, it seems like you'll be satisfied with that quote. Actually, we all came from a demoniac background, but Prabhupada had faith in the process that it will purify us. Many times, this is a subjective statement I'm making, and it's as I see it. It seems that some, especially of the some of the leaders in our movement, and not so much talking about GBC members as talking about some temple presidents who, not talking about you, who they get an area of authority and they terrorize, as that word's already been used, they terrorize the those within their jurisdiction. It seems like that, and they rule by force. You can't get away with it in the modern West, the Western world, because those who did it in the past have been dethroned, and now everything. So you can't. It's very difficult to be an authority because there's this democratic mood, and no one wants to accept any authorities. But the authority is actually required to run anything efficiently. But it's also the problem with authority, as the well-known saying, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Although that's not actually true. It's if one has the seed of corruption within one's heart, then the opportunity to exercise it will reveal that. But if one is pure in heart, then even if one has power, he'll use it well for the benefit of others, which is what we're supposed to do. So, anyway, it seems to me, in some cases, that some of the descriptions of demoniac persons in Bhagavad Gita, they do apply to some of our ISKCON leaders. They seem to have some of those propensities. But Srila Prabhupada's his policy was to keep everyone in with the idea, let them go on chanting, they'll become purified. So are there demons in our movement? Well, I know of at least one, I can say for sure. Yeah. So, what do you make of all of that?
Hey, you said there's at least one. The one?
Me. I am the one. I am the way and the untruth and the darkness. And everyone goes to hell via me. If you follow what's in my, all the crazy things in my mind, but as long as it keeps on coming out of my mouth, follow Prabhupada, then however demoniac I may be, then even from the bad mouth can come good things. Out of the strong came forth sweetness. What is that? The deadline? Well, that's something different. All right, anything else?
You were saying that Ravana knows the ways.
Ravana, yeah.
He doesn't know the goal.
Ravana knows the Vedas, but he doesn't know the goal. Well, most people who know the Vedas don't know the actual goal. And Krishna states that in Bhagavad Gita, Veda Vada Rita Pata Nanya Nistiti Vagina. Persons who take the words of the Vedas literally instead of understanding the purpose behind them. How come they don't know the goal? Because they're deluded by material desire. They're in the material world to forget Krishna. So just like a person in knowledge, he sees the tree and remembers Krishna. This tree is a living entity sees a living entity as part and parcel of Krishna, sees the design of the tree and the interaction of the tree as part of Krishna's wonderful design. And the non-devotee doesn't see Krishna. So you can see the Vedas also not see Krishna. There are so many people who study Krishna, Indologists, and they may even study, there are people who study Prabhupada's books, and they remain demons, because they have the wrong attitude. The terrorist and the nun, everyone goes to the same kind of schools, right? But then, what do you make of it all? Where do you go from there? Had the same basic education, different kind of association and different kinds of desires. Yeah, anything else?
When talking about the Jnana Chakshus, we can see that presently within our movement there's in the process of educating devotees many times in different institutions or courses where knowledge is being given also through the academic scholars using their books or whatever.
Gyana Chakshu, you say, giving the knowledge in Prabhupada's books. Well, that in the same verse in which Krishna speaks of Gyana Chakshu, as I already mentioned, the word is there, Anupashyanti, which means seeing. Anupashyanti, Anu means following. So one sees by following the teachings of the former acharya. So it suggests a parampara system, which Krishna has already mentioned. When the parampara system is broken, then the knowledge is lost. Evam parapraptam. What is that? Evam parampara. Evam parampara praptam. Evam rajashayo viduhu. Sakale neha mahata yoga nashta parantara. The knowledge is coming down, but it gets broken in course of time. So, if we don't follow the parampara system, then the knowledge, the same knowledge may be taught, but due to differing perspectives, the real understanding is lost. So if we talk about academic perspectives, if you're talking about mundane academic perspectives, then these are completely different to the transcendental perspectives. And because their perspective is committedly mundane, then one cannot understand transcendence through the mundane academic method. The scientific method means there should be empiricism, skepticism, ethical neutrality, objectivity, and these are various factors of the scientific method. Simplicity, in as much as they accept the simplest possible theory, but they don't accept any trans empiricism. It means that they don't accept anything which is not perceivable to their senses, which is actually very stupid, because if we only accept as valid knowledge that which is within the scope of our perception, then it grossly limits the possibilities of learning, because our senses are extremely limited. So, the academic method, what do I think of that? Well, give it a kick in the face, that's Prabhupada's response to all of that, with boots. Yeah, anything else?
I was just reading the other day where he talked about academic, and it was in relation to the education of the children. Prabhupada said, yes, that children should be educated in things like history and geography. Would that not be considered?
History and geography, Prabhupada said, history, Mahabharata. He may have said different things in different times and places, but he's, for the children, Prabhupada, he will say, they may get a smattering of knowledge so that they don't appear foolish in human society. But just like at school, I learned about Wellington and Napoleon and the Battle of Waterloo. And what's the use of learning all about that? How did they learn about Krishna, Srimad Bhagavatam? There have been so many battles. I guess in Ireland they learn about the Battle of the Boyne. In Northern Ireland, Protestants do, probably. The Battle of the Boyne. And then the history of that. History is just propaganda anyway. It's all lies. Actually, almost everything at school, from what I can see, is all lies. And what they teach is science. It means how they presently perceive the world through their so-called scientific eyes. And that all, it all changes, and there are so many different theories, and it's all meant just to reinforce the idea that there's no God in control. So education means indoctrination. And we want to give, if we actually want to educate children, we should teach them the truth, which you won't get from in mundane history books. You won't even get the truth about what happened, let alone the purpose of life, which is, if you learn history in one country and then you learn it in the next country, it's different. The same so-called facts, given a different perspective. Because education is meant for indoctrinating people to become servile robots of an economic system meant for exploiting people. And they say, oh, you shouldn't deprive your children of the opportunity to have a good education, which means to become a complete idiot and waste their whole life. Real education means to educate people how to differentiate between truth and falsity. You won't get that in the schools. Even though you'll get that, the idea that, yeah, we have to defend free speech and all these sacred symbols of modern Western democracy, which is another bogus idea. So many, we're trained to think that democracy, free speech, these are all sacred. But they're all used and exploited just to, it's all used for exploitation. That's all. And to hide from us the real purpose of life. So if we're going to be devotees, we have to have a completely different perspective from that of non-devotees. It's a completely different understanding of life, and the two don't mix. The mundane academic method, which begins with skepticism, and the Vaishnava method, which begins with faith, and they start from a different perspective, and they don't coalesce at any point. So that may be a tough one for you to accept, but that's a fact. You can't be a mundane. You can't have a mundane outlook and a devotional outlook at the same time. So I realize what I'm saying is not the standard outlook in ISKCON today. But from what I understand from Srila Prabhupada, the standard outlook in ISKCON today is way off. It's veered into this mundane academics and becoming part of society rather than giving guidance to society and giving a positive alternative to society. So there you are. Hare Krishna. Yeah, you want to ask something?
Yes, sir. Just saying, which the certain personalities there that came in contact with the Vedas, and they had some knowledge, like theoretically, but they didn't have to.
Certain persons came in contact with the Vedas and they had theoretical knowledge. Who are you referring to in particular?
That we spoke about today.
Mundane Indologists?
Even like Radha Kashyapu.
Yeah. Well, they didn't just come, when you say they came in touch, it's not really that they came in touch, like they went to a library and picked up a book or something like that. But the culture they were raised in was what could be broadly called Vedic culture. Persons like Radha Kashyapu. It wasn't that he was just floating through life and somehow or other he spotted a book in a second-hand bookstore about the Vedas and picked it up and took an interest in it. And he was raised in that culture. It makes a lot of difference. It makes a lot of difference to be raised in a culture and to come to it later. Generally one is highly conditioned by the culture one is raised in, which is a major problem in ISKCON today, if we don't realize that the culture that most of us were raised in is demonic, actually. The whole culture works against the understanding the purpose of life. I mean, even if everyone was, even with the present culture we have, even if, for instance, people were vegetarian, that would still be demoniac if they didn't understand that the purpose of life is godly realization, specifically Krishna consciousness. Animal slaughter is just one of the grosser manifestations of a highly materialistic culture. Yeah, so what were you going to say?
So it's the same point. They didn't learn to serve.
Yeah, you could say that's the missing point. Normative dharma is meant to inculcate a sense of selfless service. Because even though people, they may do it for getting sense gratification in a future life, but to get the pious activities by which they can do that, they have to do things like giving charity. And if they make a big display of giving the charity, they lose the benefit in future life. So they have to downplay that. So it's actually meant to train one to become selfless rather than selfish as a beginning to come out of the demoniac mentality and come to the platform of Krishna consciousness. So yeah, it's the difference between selflessness and service to others and selfishness and exploitation of others and trying to engage others in one's own service for one's own sense gratification.
Yes. Is it correct, Maharaj? You were mentioning that.
Is it correct? Well, relativity, that's another facet of the scientific method, that everything is relative. We can't really say we know anything, but when we say we know something, it means according to our present understanding, this is what we know. And it's subject to change when we find out something else. So relativity, when you say, is it correct? Do you mean, is it my opinion? Or that's what it is in our ISKCON today. Everything's become relativized and everyone's opinion. But there is actually correct, incorrect, right, wrong. So what's the question? Yeah. If I say it's correct, someone else will go, no, that's not correct, that's just his opinion. So, yeah. Therefore, we should give evidence from Shastra. Yeah, so what's the question?
You mentioned that the Ramana was within Vedic culture or following Vedic culture?
Within Vedic culture, in a broad sense, you could say. he was within Vedic culture, in a broad sense. So I mean, he was by no means an ideal. Don't follow him.
Then what activities should he have been doing? Or should he do not be in? I mean, it seems like he already captured another man's mind.
Well, not only one. Sita was one after many others. So, yeah, he violated some of the basic principles of Vedic culture, but at least superficially, there's things like studying the Vedas, performing Vedic sacrifices. He kept so many brahmanas for performing yajnas for him. He served the brahmanas, at least those whose wives he didn't steal. So presumably he would offer at least a show of respect to brahmanas, and he may have done some puja also, like this, welcoming guests in the Vedic way, even fighting, the rules of fighting, Vedic rules of fighting, and certain rules. Certainly you're not supposed to hit below the belt, hit someone who's running away, things like that. Like that. They would have followed something, but definitely they violated. Ravana and his cohorts violated many of the principles of Vedic culture, but still that's basically what they were raising.
Where's the fine line where you say how?
Well, let me say, following Vedic culture, I mean, it is in itself a relative term to say that. Just like we can say nowadays that Hindus are following Vedic culture, it's true, but it's not true to the extent that it was true of their forefathers a few generations ago. So you can still say that they're within Vedic culture, although it's becoming more and more tenuous as each day goes on. But still, you can say that. Basically, they are followers of Vedic culture. Alright, Hare Krishna. So we'll finish there. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Hare Krishna.